Anyhow, we are at 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to mute all now, and you will not have the ability to unmute yourself, except for our speaker who, whoops, sorry, hang on a second, redo this. Okay, so Howard, you'll have to unmute yourself at this point. So welcome all, members and guests. As you know, we always welcome guests at PC User Group meetings, whether it's the main meeting or Q&A sessions that are happening on other Wednesday evenings during the month. If you want to join, I did paste into the chat window URL where you can join. It's just $20 a year. And if you want to support the work that we do, we'd be happy to have you join us. But if you want to just keep coming as a guest, that's fine too. Just one announcement I want to make is that we do have elections coming up. So the nominations close December 31st of this year. We'd really love to see some additional people come forward who would like to help in the running of your user group. And so if you have any questions about what's involved in being a board member, you can certainly speak to any of the board members. We're all listed on the website under the board of directors section there. You can nominate yourself or you can nominate another member in good standing as long as they're willing to accept that nomination. And so I would encourage people to consider doing it. And, you know, it's not overly onerous task. And you can help out to users helping users in that rather unique way. So with that, I'm just going to turn it over to Howard Simcover. And the description that we had on the website, I'm just going to, you know, very briefly look at it here. And probably everybody here is actually acquainted with the what we've had on the website and on, in the newsletter. But Howard Simcover is he's had a lifelong interest in astronomy. And he was a producer lecturer with the Montreal Planetarium. He came to us a couple of years back and said that he was willing to give a presentation to the OPCUG if we were willing to entertain him as a speaker. And, of course, we jumped on that. And our last presentation that we had on astronomy was really well received. That was a few years back. So we thought it was an opportune time to have Howard come join us. And he's going to talk to us tonight about celestial shadows, eclipses of the sun and moon. And with that, Howard, I will stop my share. And okay, you can take over. So thanks very much.
Okay. Well, it's a pleasure and an honor to be here. So let me start my own share. Remembering to share the sound.
Actually, this is a little bit odd, Howard. I'm going to just interrupt. We do have a gray bar that is going across. We have two gray bars that are going across right now.
Yeah. Hopefully they're gone.
Bottom line, yeah, they're both gone. Good.
Okay.
Good to go.
Okay. Excellent. Well, I really want to thank all of you and Chris for the very kind invitation. I'm really happy to be here and to spend this time with you tonight. As Chris said, I have a lifelong interest in astronomy, and I have a particular interest in eclipses, which I will talk about tonight. I'm going to talk both about lunar and solar eclipses, but the vast majority of the time I'll spend with you tonight will be about eclipses of the sun. So I want to start off simply by saying that a total eclipse of the sun, to me, is perhaps the most beautiful event in nature. It just leaves you stunned with the ethereal beauty of the experience, and it makes you want to see another one and another one and another one. It's almost addictive. So I'm going to begin with what might appear to be a digression. But we're going to start with our solar system, the family of planets that orbit our sun. So here you see most of the planets. There are eight of them. If I had been speaking to you a number of years ago, I would have said nine, because I think most of you know that back in 2006, Pluto was demoted to what we call a dwarf planet. But long ago, and we are quite sure about this because we can see it happening elsewhere in the universe, between 5 and 6 billion years ago, we are very sure that in the place where our solar system now is, there was a giant cloud of dust and gas slowly rotating. And it was rotating in what we would call today the counterclockwise direction. But gravity was operating in this cloud, and gravity was pulling the dust and gas inward. So over hundreds of millions of years, it began to collapse downward into a disk, and in the center, a very large mass of material began to form. And as gravity pulled more and more material into that central mass, its temperature went up. Eventually, the temperature reached several millions of degrees, and thermonuclear reactions began. It began to shine and became a star, our sun. And in the outer regions of that disk that was collapsing, other pockets of gravitational condensation formed, and this ultimately became the planets traveling around the sun, which is what we see today. The planets and the sun itself share the original angular momentum of that giant gas cloud. So they are all revolving in the counterclockwise direction. Now, eclipses are actually all about alignments and shadows. Alignments can happen in our solar system because most of the objects, not all of them, but most of them are orbiting in nearly the same geometric plane. And it's because of the way that original gas cloud collapsed and the way the physics operates as the collapse occurs to pull the objects into a fairly flat disk. So if we look today sideways at the solar system, where that dotted line running from left to right is the plane of the orbit of the Earth, the other planets more or less are orbiting in pretty well the same plane, maybe a degree up or a degree down. Mercury is a bit of an exception. It is its orbit is inclined 7 degrees to the orbit of the Earth, but more or less, all of the planets and the sun would fit into a tabletop. And that is what leads to these possible alignments in the skies of the Earth when we look outwards. So let me give you some examples. Here's a picture I took from my roof in Sandy Hill, Ottawa, in February of 1999. And I'm still in the same condominium. I can no longer get that view. At the time, I could see Parliament around 2.5 kilometers to the east of me. That's now blocked by a very annoying large apartment building. But you see in the sky here of February 22nd, 1999, two very bright objects, and they're very close together. The brighter one is the planet Venus. The one above it is the planet Jupiter. Now, look, one day later, look how close they are. And the point is that this alignment occurs because the orbits of Venus and the Earth and Jupiter are very nearly in the same plane. Here's another example. In 1974, I was living in Montreal. I got up at 4:30 in the morning and took this picture from the roof of my apartment building in Montreal. You see the moon and a very bright object next to it. That is the planet Venus. And again, this alignment occurs because the orbit of the moon is more or less in the same plane as the orbit of the Earth and the orbit of Venus. So if objects in the solar system can come together and align in the sky, it also means that their shadows can align. Their shadows can cross one another. take a look at this. Well, that is the ringed planet Saturn. It's a real picture. We can never obtain this view from here on the Earth, but this picture was taken by the Cassini spacecraft, which orbited Saturn for many years up till the year 2017. Now, you'll notice here that Saturn has a shadow, and the shadow is falling onto the rings. Here's another example. Here's the planet Jupiter seen through a large amateur-sized telescope. You see two of Jupiter's many moons, and the shadows of those moons are falling onto the upper atmosphere of Jupiter. Again, an alignment between the moon, its shadow, and Jupiter that can only occur because the orbits of the moons are more or less in the same plane as the orbit of Jupiter itself. So we'll turn now to one type of eclipse, and this is an eclipse of the moon. And I'm sure everyone here on the Zoom call tonight has seen an eclipse of the moon. They're very beautiful, and they can be seen when they occur from one entire side of the Earth. An eclipse of the moon can only happen at the time of full moon, when the moon is fully illuminated by the sun as we observe it from here on the surface of the Earth. So here's what's really happening, and I always have to say that this diagram is not to scale at all. Well, the Earth is a solid object, and as a solid object, it has a shadow. The shadow of the Earth is like a long conical dunce cap. It's 1.4 million kilometers long. And at the distance of the moon, it still has a very wide cross-section, wide enough, something like 9,000 kilometers across, so the moon can actually fit completely inside it. And when the moon is full, often it will pass above or below the shadow of the Earth. But if the geometry is just right, the moon can pass directly through the Earth's shadow, giving us a lunar eclipse. Something that is quite interesting, and maybe not something you would expect, is that inside the shadow of the Earth, it is not completely dark. The atmosphere of the Earth here at the edge will bend or refract sunlight into the shadow. And it tends to be the longer wavelengths that are bent or refracted in, the orange or the red colors. So when the moon is in total eclipse, it will very often have a reddish or even a bright orange color. And the brightness and the color will change from one eclipse to the other. It's very dependent on the degree of cloudiness, the amount of dust, and the overall state of the atmosphere here at the very edges of the Earth. Here are some pictures I took of a total eclipse of the moon around a year and a half ago. It takes a little over an hour for the moon to very gradually move in its orbit into the shadow of the Earth. You'll notice something interesting here as the eclipse has progressed, and that's that the edge of the shadow, which is fuzzy, the edge of the Earth's shadow is curved. And if you think about it, the Earth that we are standing on is round, and a sphere is the only geometric object that will always cast a round shadow, a shadow that is round in cross-section. The ancient Greek philosophers were aware of this more than 2,000 years ago. So this was one of the proofs the ancient Greeks used to demonstrate that the Earth itself must be round. Now, I'm going to show you next a very short video, and these are pictures I took of the lunar eclipse of May 15th, 2022. So I hope you enjoy it. Here we go. Pretty eclipse. I hope some of you saw it. It occurred from around 10:30 in the evening till midnight on May 15th, 2022, and I remember it very well. All of those pictures were taken from my rooftop here in Sandy Hill, just east of downtown. Now, in the past 2 years, we've been very fortunate to see and be able to see three eclipses of the moon visible from eastern Canada, and you see the dates here. Now, you might wonder, when is the next one? When is the next one that we can see from eastern Canada? It's in around 18 months, and it will be on the evening of March 14th, 2025. Now, fortunately, it's going to occur at a good time of the evening. And by contrast, the one in November 2022 happened at 5 o'clock in the morning Eastern Time. But the March 14th, 2025 eclipse will be in the late evening between about 10:30 and 11:30 at night. And of course, I hope it's clear and I hope we all get a very good view. Now, something that no human being has yet seen or experienced is this. Imagine what it would be like if we could stand on the surface of the moon during a total lunar eclipse. It would be an amazing sight. The Earth in the sky would be completely covered by the sun. We'd be experiencing a total eclipse of the sun from the surface of the moon. And all around the edge of the Earth would be a brilliant red-orange glow of sunlight being refracted through the atmosphere of the Earth. The surface of the moon around us would have this orange color. The amount of light would be fairly bright. You probably could easily read a newspaper by the light passing through the atmosphere of the Earth and also reaching us from the corona of the sun. So now we're going to leave lunar eclipses and we'll go to the main part of the topic, eclipses of the sun itself, as seen from here on the Earth. And of course, these are caused by the moon's shadow touching the Earth. Now, before we go into this in more detail, let's think about the Earth and the moon themselves. The moon is about one quarter the diameter of the Earth. It means you could fit roughly 64 moons inside the Earth. So the moon is a fairly small celestial object. But by an amazing coincidence, and that's all it is, it's a coincidence, the moon is 400 times smaller than the sun. So this is what we experienced in Northern Australia in 2012, and for a very brief time, and in this case it was 1 minute 44 seconds, the moon completely covered the sun. You can see the sun's corona stretching outwards. This is the outer atmosphere of the sun. You can see rays and structure in the corona, which are following the magnetic field of the sun. So what causes this to happen? What is really going on geometrically? Well, the moon is traveling around the Earth, and as I mentioned, the plane of the moon's orbit is more or less in the same plane as the orbit of the Earth around the Sun. So if the alignment is correct, the long shadow of the Moon, and that shadow is barely long enough to be able to reach the Earth, the end of the shadow touches the Earth's surface and traces out a very narrow path that we call the path of totality. The Moon is traveling around the Earth, moving counterclockwise. It's moving at a little under 4,000 kilometers per hour. So the shadow of the Moon moves very quickly across the surface of the Earth. Now, the Earth is rotating in the same direction as the shadow is moving. So that will tend to slow the shadow down relative to the surface. But the speed of the shadow is typically more than 1,000 miles per hour, usually much more than 1,000 miles per hour. So even a jet plane cannot keep up with it unless it's a supersonic jet. Now, the width of the path, the width of this path of totality, is never more than roughly 200 kilometers wide. It's a very narrow track. Now, it's true that people out here and out there will see the Sun partly covered, but to see it completely covered, you must be within the path of totality. And this path, even though it may be many thousands of kilometers long, is very narrow, and very few people relative to the overall population of the Earth happen to be located within the path. So here's a close-up of the path, and it shows you that as the shadow moves along, you really want to be near the middle of the path. We call that the central line, because there you will experience the longest period of totality. If you're near the edge of the path, the Sun will be covered for a much shorter time. Now, you might wonder how long eclipses can last. Typically, they are 2 or 3 or 4 minutes. On very rare occasions, they can be 6 or 7 minutes or a bit longer. And I'll tell you a bit more about that later. But most of the time, they are very brief. You have only a couple of minutes to really enjoy and take in the experience. Now, if you were in space looking down, and this is a real picture taken from a spacecraft orbiting the Earth in August 1999, you can look down on the shadow of the Moon. This eclipse went over Great Britain, where it was cloudy, over much of Europe, where it was partly clear, and over Turkey, where my wife and I were in very, very clear skies for that beautiful eclipse of 1999. Eclipses also occur on other planets, but we are very fortunate to have the ones that are the most dramatic. And let's take an example of another planet, the planet Mars. Mars has two very tiny moons. They're so small, they were only discovered in the late 19th century. So here is one of them. It's called Phobos. It looks a bit like a potato. It's the size of Ottawa. That's how small it is. The long axis of this moon is only around 27 kilometers long. It's a very small object. If you look down onto the surface of Mars from a spacecraft, as this picture shows you, you can see the shadow of Phobos on the surface. But the shadow is not deep enough because the Moon is not big enough to cover the Sun completely as seen from the surface of Mars. The Moon is not big enough to do the job. We have always known this, but here we can actually see it. And this little video was taken by one of the rovers on Mars last year. So here you see Phobos in real time, moving across the face of the Sun. Much, much too small to cover the Sun. You don't get a total eclipse. So a question we can ask is, are total eclipses of the sun rare? They certainly are perceived to be rare, once-in-a-lifetime spectacles. But in fact, the answer is yes and no. If you stay in the same place, like Ottawa or Calgary or Cincinnati or Payson, Arizona, you might have to wait around 360 years on average between total eclipses of the sun. So for any one location, they are very rare. But if you're willing to travel, if you're willing to travel within or outside North America, you can experience a total eclipse of the sun on average about every 18 months. So for the Earth as a whole, they really are fairly common. In a lifetime, if you're willing to travel, you might be able to see as many as 30 or 35 or even 40 total eclipses of the sun. And I know a couple of people who have seen more than 35. An eclipse of the sun can only happen at new moon. Conversely, as I showed you, an eclipse of the moon can only happen at full moon. So we won't spend a lot of time on this diagram, but think of the sun over here at the right and sunlight coming from right to left. So here's the full moon fully illuminated on the other side of the Earth. If you look at the first quarter moon, where half the moon is illuminated by the sun, and as we look at it, we see half of the moon illuminated, the shadow of the moon is nowhere near the Earth at first quarter. It's only at new moon, when the moon is between the sun and the Earth, and this happens once in 29 and a half days, only then is there a possibility, and I emphasize a possibility, that the shadow of the moon can fall onto the Earth. So again, you might ask this question, if eclipses of the sun can only happen at new moon, then why don't we have an eclipse of the sun every month, every time there's a new moon? And the answer is, the orbit of the moon is inclined a little bit to the orbit of the Earth. It's inclined by just over 5 degrees. So usually at new moon, there is no eclipse. The moon will pass above or below the sun. So let's take an example here. This is what I call case number one. The little green circle is the Earth. The little blue circle is the moon. If you are standing on the little green circle, the Earth, and you look towards the sun, and then you look towards the moon at new moon, notice you are looking downward through an angle of a few degrees. And therefore, if you look at the upper right, the moon will seem to pass under the sun and miss it, and there is no eclipse. The other case is where the moon passes above the sun. Again, you're on the Earth, the little green sphere. You look towards the sun, but to see the moon, you must elevate your gaze by 2 or 3 or 4 degrees, and therefore the moon misses the sun passing above it. There is no eclipse. For you to have an eclipse, the Earth and the moon must be at points in their orbits where there's an intersection of their orbital planes. This situation happens every 6 months, but even then, it's not a guarantee that you're going to get a total eclipse of the sun. You might get some kind of an eclipse, like a partial eclipse, but not necessarily total. I will provide you, by the way, I will send this to Chris Taylor, a subset of the images in this PowerPoint deck, including this one, that demonstrates the geometry and shows that you can only occasionally have the correct alignment that will give you a total eclipse of the sun. Now, people thousands of years ago did not really understand what was happening. Certainly, the geometers and the astronomers among the ancient Egyptians, the ancient Greeks, and the ancient Babylonians knew that when there was a solar eclipse, they were perfectly aware that it was the moon that was passing in front of the sun, but they had no real way to predict when and where solar eclipses would happen. Now, in fact, the first person who very accurately predicted the path of a total eclipse was Sir Edmund Halley. And he is perhaps best known for the comet that bears his name. Halley did not discover the comet, but he predicted that it would return in the year 1758. He realized that the comet had appeared in the skies of the Earth many times previously. He did orbital calculations, made that prediction. He did not live to see it because he died in the 1740s, but the comet, in fact, returned on time and was seen at first on Christmas Day of 1758. But Halley made very accurate predictions for the path of the total eclipse of early May 1715 that went right over southern Britain. Now remember, and I realize I'm talking to the Ottawa PC Users Group, this was long before the time of Alan Turing. This was long before the time of Charles Babbage. There were no digital computers. There were no mechanical calculators. All of his calculations were done by hand. It was very, very complex. And he got the path of totality to within about 10 miles north and south. And this was 300 years ago. He did an amazing job. The eclipse was seen in southern Britain and in Europe, and his calculations, in fact, bore fruit. Now, here are the paths of total eclipses of the sun in North America in the latter part of the 20th century. These are some of the eclipses, not all. And because we now know very, very accurately the orbit of the moon, we know exactly where the moon is to within centimeters at any moment of time, we can make these predictions with amazing precision. Now, I'm going to point out two eclipse tracks. One is March 7th, 1970. That eclipse came up over Florida, where it was cloudy. It was clear in the Carolinas and Virginia, cloudy at Nantucket Island, and came up through Nova Scotia, where it was also cloudy. Notice this track just 2 years later, July 10th, 1972, and the two tracks intersect in Nova Scotia, where it was cloudy both times. Nova Scotia just is not a great place to see eclipses of the sun, but those are the breaks. Now, the 1972 eclipse is very famous. I'm sure you've heard of it, although you may not have quite realized the context. And the 1972 eclipse was made famous by none other than Carly Simon with the song You're So Vain. I'm sure you all know the song. And it was thought by many people that Carly was singing about Warren Beatty. In fact, she admitted decades later that one verse of the song was about Warren Beatty. Other verses were about two other men. Now, listen, and you will recall that she mentions the total eclipse of July 1972. And indeed, that's how she made that eclipse famous, and the song was released only 4 or 5 months after that total eclipse. Eclipses have been mentioned in stories, most famously perhaps by Mark Twain in A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. The hero traveled back in time to the time of King Arthur, the year 528 apparently. He got into a jam and he was going to be executed. So he predicted, because he knew there was a total eclipse, he said, that occurred on June 21st of the year 528. Now, Mark Twain just made that up. There really was no eclipse on that date, but it saved his life in the book. And here's Bing Crosby in the movie of the same name. And there's a scene from the 1949 movie showing the total eclipse of the sun, the fictitious eclipse in the year 528. Solar eclipses have also appeared in many movies. These are some examples. The one at the bottom is interesting. Dolores Claiborne, that is a book by Stephen King. Stephen King lives in the state of Maine in the United States. He was aware that a total eclipse crossed the state of Maine on July 20th, 1963, and this appears in the movie.
Eclipse lasted 6.5 minutes. They said it was some kind of record. It was a hell of a lot more than a thunderhead passing across the sun. It was beautiful.
It was beautiful, but it didn't last 6.5 minutes. That eclipse in 1963 was more like 2 minutes, but Stephen King and the producers of the movie took a bit of poetic license. Now, here are some eclipse tracks across the world in the 1970s and 1980s. Take a look here. There's the track for March 7th, 1970. And here's another one 18 years later on March 17th of 1988. Now, I'd like you to look at the shape of the eclipse tracks. And notice they are almost the same shape. Now, that is not a coincidence. And what's happening here is that the sun and the moon move in a repeating pattern in the sky. And the pattern repeats in 18 years, 11 days, and 8 hours. And this pattern has been known for thousands of years. It's called the Saros. Now, it means that if you have an eclipse today, then 18 years, 11 days, and 8 hours from today, there will be another eclipse. But because of the 8 hours, the Earth will have made one-third of a spin, one-third of 24 hours. So the eclipse gets shifted one-third of the way around the Earth towards the west. So a question you can ask is, if a Saros is 18 years, why don't we have to wait 18 years between total eclipses? How is it that we get eclipses about every 1 or 2 years? And the answer is that there are something like 40 or 45 of these Saros cycles occurring at the same time. Now, here is one called Saros number 139. They have numbers. And this Saros started in the year 1501. It will last over 1,200 years, and it has 71 eclipses in the entire series. This, I think, gives you a notion of the sweep of time that we are dealing with. But here are 4 consecutive eclipses in that Saros. March 7th, 1970. In Mexico, the U.S., and Nova Scotia. 18 years later, it gets shifted to the Philippines and Indonesia. 18 years after that, in 2006, the eclipse comes to Egypt, the Middle East, and Turkey. And 18 years after that, in 5 months, on April 8th, 2024, the eclipse comes back to North America, in Mexico, the U.S., and Eastern Canada, and I will show you that later. So here is the eclipse track of March 7th, 1970. There it is on March 18th, 1988, over the Philippines and the Pacific Ocean. 2006, over Africa and the Middle East. And here, April 8th, 2024, again in North America. Now, I've had the very good fortune and the honor to be at three of those. Here I am in North Carolina on March 7th, 1970, using black and white film. In the Philippines on March 18th, 1988. No gray hair yet. And my wife and I in the Sahara Desert in Libya on March 29th, 2006. And like all of you, I think I'm waiting for April 8th of 2024. So here's a summary of the concepts. You can only have a solar eclipse at new moon. The tilt of the moon's orbit makes the moon miss the sun most of the time. Solar eclipses repeat in this Saros cycle of just over 18 years. Successive eclipses in the Saros are shifted a third of the way around the Earth in a westward direction. There are many Saros cycles happening at the same time, so you don't have to wait 18 years between eclipses, and we get a total eclipse of the sun somewhere on the Earth on average about every 1.5 years. So let's look at some examples, and these are personal examples. I'm going to try to demonstrate some of the things you can see and experience through these examples. So we're going to start with 6 months ago, April 8th, 2023, Exmouth, Western Australia. Now you see it's a very narrow eclipse track, very, very thin, very narrow, and it just touches a little peninsula in Western Australia, about 1,200 kilometers north of Perth. So here is our eclipse group boarding a chartered aircraft at 4 o'clock in the morning in Perth, Australia. We are flying up to the eclipse path at Exmouth, and absolutely everything depended on that charter flight. If there had been a mechanical problem, if the flight had been delayed, we would have missed the eclipse. Fortunately, everything went on time and correctly. So we landed at Exmouth. Here we are by the shores of the Indian Ocean. There were over 1,000 people set up to observe at this particular location. Here is my wife Louise using a special filter to watch the partial phase of the eclipse before totality, and here is what she has to say.
So, it's Louise. I'm in Exmouth, Australia, and I'm about to see currently total eclipse number 7 for me, and we're by the Indian Ocean, which I think is very romantic, and everybody here is very busy like a bee, observing each other and observing what's happening in the sky, and it's a very good place.
Yes, a very good place to be. So here is the equipment that I use. The pictures you will see were taken through this long telephoto lens. This is through a filter and is the very end of the partial eclipse, maybe 2 to 3 minutes before the moon completely covers the sun. And what's really important, you have to remember just in the last seconds of partial eclipse to take the filter off the camera, because otherwise you will get no pictures of totality. You must use the filter before the sun is covered. When the sun is covered, it is perfectly safe to look directly at the solar corona with no eye protection. You can even look at the total eclipse through a telescope or binoculars. Here, totality is just beginning. Notice that the corona starts to appear, and we get this dazzling beam of light, sunlight passing through valleys and craters just at the very edge of the moon. We call that the diamond ring, and these little beams of light are named after a 19th century astronomer called Bailey. They're called Bailey's beads. And here we see jets of hydrogen gas on the sun shooting outward. These are called prominences. A longer exposure brings out the breadth of the solar corona, showing these long rays of structure following the magnetic field of the sun. And then 62.4 seconds later, we get the second diamond ring and the eclipse is over. 62.4 seconds, a very short eclipse. Now, I'm going to play you a little video. This shows what happens just at the beginning of totality. And it's a very exciting and emotional thing. There's a lot of excitement among the people. And if you are in a crowd of people on April 8th, 2024, at the upcoming eclipse, hopefully you will experience this too. Now, I want you to watch carefully the shadow of my tripod leg. Watch the shadow disappear as the sun becomes completely covered. And listen for me calling out, the corona is visible. The corona is coming out.
It's in Jupiter as well, actually, now.
There, the corona's out. The corona's out.
Oh, yes, you can see the corona.
And there you have it from Exmouth, Australia, 6 months ago. Now, there's another type of solar eclipse, and this is called the annular eclipse. So the moon is orbiting the Earth once in 29 or 30 days. The moon's orbit is not perfectly circular. It's elliptical. And this means that sometimes the moon is a bit closer, sometimes it's a bit farther away. I think you all know that if we get a full moon when the moon is very close, the media have taken to calling that a supermoon. You probably heard a lot of publicity about supermoons. Well, if the moon is a bit farther away than average, its shadow will not reach the surface of the Earth if the moon happens to pass across the face of the sun. So this is the situation you get, is that the tip of the shadow will be here, maybe 30 or 40,000 kilometers short, and it will miss the surface of the Earth by a wide margin. So instead of a total eclipse along this path, you get what we call an annular eclipse. And if you are in the path, you will see the moon directly in front of the sun, but it will leave a brilliant ring of sunlight all around the edge. The sky does not get particularly dark. You cannot see the corona. You don't see many of the phenomena of a total eclipse, but it's still very interesting. 3 weeks ago, Albuquerque, New Mexico, in the United States, Saturday morning, October 14th, 2023. There is the path of the annular eclipse on that date. It goes across the southwestern United States, Central America, and South America. here is the path, and you can see that the central line of the eclipse just misses the city of Albuquerque. In fact, the central line went very close to a large park, Arroyo del Oso Park. So here is a picture my wife took of me in Arroyo del Oso Park the day before the eclipse. And here we are in the park all set up with our equipment and our little Canadian flag. There were maybe 200 people in the park to observe the eclipse. So here you see the moon beginning to cross the sun. And here I held up this postcard, which has a little hole in it that projects on a piece of cardboard through this pinhole a small solar crescent. It's a very interesting thing to do. This fellow who was observing nearby was much more adventurous and certainly very ingenious. He took a piece of cardboard and punched a whole bunch of little holes in it, making out the words eclipse 14th October 2023. And you see it projects a whole little series of solar crescents onto the ground and onto a white piece of paper. So here you can see that the moon is too small to do the job. It's not going to cover the sun completely. And this is my sequence taken through that telephoto lens showing the formation of the ring, the perfect annularity, which lasts only a few seconds, because after a few seconds, the ring becomes asymmetrical. And then the ring breaks like this. And I actually photographed it in a video, which you can watch in real time. Watch the ring break at the bottom. So that is exactly the way it looked 3 weeks ago on October 14th. You might wonder, what kinds of science can we do during a total eclipse of the sun? And the fact is that today, in the 21st century, we can't do as much as we did 100 or 200 years ago. We don't need to, because we can observe the sun from space using space telescopes and equipment above the atmosphere. But we can still gather measurements to help us understand the corona and other physical aspects of the sun. Over 100 years ago, eclipses were a very good opportunity to search for planets closer to the sun than Mercury, and none were ever found. And 100 years ago, they helped us prove Einstein's general theory of relativity. Einstein developed two theories for which he is famous. The special theory is a theory of space and time. The general theory, which came 10 years later, is a theory of gravity. Einstein's general relativity says that gravity, which we feel as a force, is actually a distortion of the fabric of space and time, a kind of bending of space and time. So if you are in space and you are not near any massive object like the sun or the earth, space-time is flat and a beam of light will travel in a perfectly straight line. But Einstein predicted in 1915 that near a large object with a gravitational field, a beam of light will bend, as you see here. And he said that if a beam of light from a star was passing near the edge of the sun, it would bend through an angle of 1 3/4 seconds of arc. It's a very, very small angle. 1 degree has 3,600 seconds. When you look at the moon in the sky, it subtends an angle of 1,800 seconds. And Einstein predicted that the bending of light at the edge of the sun was only 1.75 seconds. Another way to visualize this is take a nickel and move it away more than 4 kilometers, and that will subtend an angle of 1 second. So the astronomers realized that they needed an eclipse to happen at the end of May, because at the end of May, the sun appears in the daytime sky, but right in a cluster of stars called the Hyades cluster. And they were hoping to measure the bending of starlight from stars in the Hyades cluster. But they needed an eclipse to happen at the end of May. That is the only time the sun will be in a cluster of stars. Well, incredibly, Einstein made the prediction in 1915. And in May of 1919, there was an eclipse over South America and Africa. Arthur Eddington, a very famous British astronomer, mounted 2 expeditions to observe that eclipse using massive equipment. They photographed the eclipse, and on this photographic plate, in all these little circles here, there are stars of the Hyades star cluster. They measured the bending of the light to demonstrate that these stars appeared slightly out of position, and it vindicated the prediction by Einstein. So an eclipse of the sun led to a proof of the general theory of relativity. And about 15 years later, Eddington ended up on the cover of Time magazine. Onward with other examples. Now, you might think you need your head examined to go to Libya, but when my wife and I went there in 2006, Libya was actually very stable, and we felt very safe there. So here we are in the Sahara Desert with a couple of thousand other eclipse chasers from all around the world. Here we were holding up the key to our cabin on our ship, projecting little solar crescents onto a piece of cardboard. People prayed just before the eclipse. Here you see a long and beautiful diamond ring with a brilliant red prominence. Very long horizontal rays on the corona. Notice the sky during the eclipse. You see, we are in the center of the moon's shadow, and about 70 kilometers away, the sun is shining all around us. So during the eclipse, you get the colors of a 360-degree sunset. It's absolutely stunning. And all too quickly, the second diamond ring arrives, and the eclipse is over. You can also see solar eclipses from a ship. I have done that 3 times. I was clouded out once, but have been to 3 eclipses at sea. This one went over the Caribbean, including the island of Curaçao. So here's our ship on the morning of the eclipse and leaving Curaçao to go out to the central line. And notice the sky is completely cloudy. There were a couple of thousand people on the ship who were despondent, but when we got perhaps 20 to 30 kilometers away from the island, the sky cleared. Everything was perfect. There was not 1 square inch of deck space available other than for people and cameras and telescopes. Here is my wife, Louise, using a filter to observe the partial phases. There is the first diamond ring, totality, again, long streaming rays in the corona, and the second diamond ring seen from the deck of the ship. Now, just to show you that things don't always go exactly as planned, That was the case for the annular in 1994. This particular eclipse went across the U.S. and parts of Canada, including Nova Scotia again, as you see. Nova Scotia is blessed with many eclipses and also gets lots of clouds, I'm afraid. I had planned to see the eclipse from near Syracuse, New York, maybe a 4 to 5 hour drive south of Ottawa. But it was very cloudy there, and Syracuse was out. But you'll notice that Toledo, Ohio, is right on the central line. Well, I had a number of friends and colleagues in northern Pennsylvania, and they had access to an aeroplane. So here we are on the morning of the eclipse, getting ready to fly, flying over northern Pennsylvania, over the fog, flying over Cleveland, landing at Toledo, and here I am, no gray hair, using this equipment beside the runway of Toledo Airport. Now, this is something you can do at the upcoming eclipse. When the sun is nearly covered, the sun as a crescent becomes like a point source of light in one direction. And so the vertical shadows are sharp and the horizontal shadows are fuzzy. And you only experience that during a solar eclipse. So here are my pictures of the May 1994 annular eclipse, where the ring forms, becomes a perfect annulus around the sun, and the ring breaks. The eclipse got a great deal of publicity. It even stopped a baseball game in the Syracuse area for 15 minutes. I took temperature measurements during the eclipse using a simple thermometer and noticed that it dropped by over 5 degrees Celsius from the beginning of the annular eclipse to the middle. And that is very typical. You could really feel the drop in temperature. I'm going to show you just two more. And again, I'm trying to demonstrate the differences between eclipses and what you can experience and observe. This annular in 1984 was very, very special. It passed across the southern United States, but the track as it went by Atlanta and into South Carolina was extremely narrow. The shadow of the moon almost could reach the surface of the Earth. It was almost a total eclipse. In fact, the path of annularity you see between the two black lines at the top and the bottom, as the path went over Atlanta, Georgia, was only about 30 city blocks wide. So my colleagues and I think two of them are on this Zoom call tonight, we positioned ourselves at the center line. The publicity was huge in Atlanta, eclipse fever taking over the city. Here I am with my equipment. We set up in the parking lot of a church, as I recall, and you can see it was a beautiful, clear, and cool day. Now notice that the moon appears to be almost the same size as the sun. It's almost a total eclipse. Now this is photographed without the filter. I did not see this because I had to protect my eyes, but the camera saw it. You can see these Bailey's beads or beams of light breaking through mountains and valleys at the edge of the moon. Here is the red chromosphere, or lowest part of the atmosphere of the sun. 10 seconds later, the moon shifts to the left. We see the chromosphere on the left. The last example I will show you is July 1981, Siberia, in the old USSR. This eclipse went all the way across the USSR, out over the Pacific north of Japan, and ended at sunset near the Hawaiian Islands. So I was in Bratsk, which is an industrial city in Siberia. It was beautiful weather. It felt like a day in August in Ottawa, very similar temperature and climate to what we have here. The sun rises into a clear sky on eclipse morning. We set up next to a reservoir. There's a large group of Canadians. I had the honor at this eclipse, while I was wearing this peculiar T-shirt, to meet Wendy Carlos. Now, she, even today, is considered to be one of the best photographers of eclipses in the world, and you'll see some of her pictures later. She's also a brilliant musician, and in the late 1960s was the first person in the world to use the Moog synthesizer to create electronic music. And in 1972, for Stanley Kubrick, she did the soundtrack for A Clockwork Orange. I've met Wendy at two eclipses in 1981 and about 10 years later. So here is a set of photos of the 1981 eclipse from Siberia. Notice this brilliant long ray in the corona that was easily visible to the naked eye. Now, remember, I mentioned that the eclipse track ended near the Hawaiian Islands. Now, somebody I know was on a chartered airplane at almost 38,000 feet near Hawaii and took these photographs of the eclipse through the airplane window. I have never seen an eclipse from an airplane, but I know many people who've done this a number of times, and it's an absolutely guaranteed way to see it because you can get thousands of meters above the tops of the clouds. Now, I mentioned that eclipses can be very short, maybe 40, 50, 60 seconds. They can also be several minutes. The longest possible eclipse, theoretically, is 7 minutes, 31 seconds. And the geometry has to be exactly right. There's about 5 geometric factors that come into play, and they must all align perfectly. So when's that going to happen? It's in the year 2186, about 160 years from now. Totality will be 7 minutes and 29 seconds, and it will happen on the ocean off the coast of Brazil. So I have to look into cryogenic freezing and have myself rejuvenated. I'm really looking forward to seeing that eclipse from a ship in about 160 years. Now, I promised you I would tell you about the upcoming eclipse for North America that will go very close to the city of Ottawa and through many parts of the northeastern United States, Monday afternoon, April 8th, 2024. And starting around January or February, I predict you're going to be seeing a huge amount of publicity about this eclipse. So you'll notice that the path of totality between the green lines misses Ottawa by a little bit. It also misses Toronto, but it gets Mississauga. It gets Montreal, barely. And then it goes off into the eastern townships. So here's a close-up of the path near Ottawa. You see Kingston is in the path, and so is Cornwall. Now, one piece of advice I have for you is please don't stay in Ottawa. In Ottawa, you'll get a 98.5% partial eclipse, but the partial eclipse is nothing compared to totality. Please try to get into the path. And please don't try to drive to Cornwall at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on April the 8th, because I guarantee you 75,000 people will be trying to do the same thing. So what can you do to plan for this eclipse, where totality in eastern Ontario will be around 3:25 in the afternoon? First of all, you need a safe, accredited solar filter. They will be widely available. They're even available today from the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada. They're available today from Amazon.ca. Don't wait until April the 1st. You will not get one then. Order one early and you will be fine. Decide where you want to be and plan your travel. Don't try to travel to the path on the afternoon of eclipse day. Don't try to cross to the central line in upstate New York on eclipse day. You will never get across the border. Thousands of people will be doing the same thing. Think about booking a hotel for the night before somewhere in the path and make that reservation many months ahead of time. Watch the weather very carefully. And remember, mobility is the key because the chances of clouds are actually about 60%. But if you're able to travel east or west on the path, you can be fine. I will be providing a subset of this deck to Chris, and this website gives wonderful information about the eclipse. So good luck in April. So a few final thoughts as I'm coming to the end. Why bother to chase total eclipses of the sun? Well, they're all, in fact, very different because the geometry is different. You get varying conditions in the atmosphere. They're all astonishingly beautiful. The shape of the corona is different from eclipse to eclipse. The diamond rings are different from eclipse to eclipse. So is the appearance of the sky. At some eclipses, the sky is very dark. You can see the brightest stars and planets in the sky. At other eclipses, the sky is brighter. It's also an opportunity to visit other places and other countries and to appreciate the geography, the people, and the culture and the history of the locations to which you are traveling. I've been to many eclipses. I would love to go to many more, and I would encourage you to try to see at least one or two in your lifetime. You will not regret it. So we're going to close the program tonight and then move to some Q&A on this presentation. And this little video has a number of images that are mine, but the majority of the images are by other people around the world, including images by Wendy Carlos. So I hope you enjoy this, and I hope the video gives you a lasting sense of the astonishing beauty of this amazing natural event, a total or annular eclipse of the sun. So it has been a real pleasure. I'm going to stop the share, and I'd be delighted to take any questions or any comments. Thank you all very much for this opportunity to speak to you tonight. So over to you, Chris, if there are questions from the group.
Okay, thank you very much. What I'm going to do is I can't force unmutes, but I can mute all and check the box saying allow participants to unmute themselves. So now anybody can unmute themselves if they want to ask a question audibly, or you can continue to use the chat. We had a couple of questions in the chat. Tom asked if the Webb telescope, could the Webb telescope be eclipsed by the Earth? And I thought, correct me if I'm wrong, Howard, I thought that being at the Lagrange point it is, it would actually be eclipsed by the Earth most of the time, is it not? You'll have to unmute yourself again, Howard.
Yeah, I had to unmute myself. It is at the Lagrange point, but remember, it's something like a million miles away. And so the Earth subtends a very, very tiny angle at that distance. And remember, the shadow of the Earth is only about, in miles, it's 850,000 miles long. Okay. So even if the Earth were absolutely lined up with the sun, the Earth would be just a tiny, tiny black dot on the face of the sun. So it's not really eclipsed. And the other thing is the Webb telescope is not exactly at the Lagrange point. It's actually orbiting a certain distance around the Lagrange point. I forget the distance from the Lagrange point, but it's fairly close to it.
Yeah. Oh, very interesting. Thanks. We also had a question from Louise. What did the letters on Eddington's slide signify?
Yeah, those were Greek letters, and they related to the Greek letter designations of the stars in the Hyades star cluster. Those were the stars for which they were trying to measure the amount of deflection or bending of the light from those stars as they passed by the edge of the sun.
Okay. We had some advice from Tom to make sure if you are crossing the border to view the eclipse next spring, to make sure you have a passport with 6+ months validity if you're trying to cross the border. Good advice on that. Jocelyn asked where would you suggest to buy a simple filter? You did mention Amazon Canada. Are there other places? And he also wanted to know if there's a simple way to check that the filter is actually safe.
Yeah, probably the best way is to just go through the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada. So they are providing only accredited, absolutely safe filters. So that's rasc.ca, and they are making these filters available. So
Is there a charge that they have for those?
Yeah, they're probably a couple of dollars per filter. Here's one I'm holding up. This is one I took to Albuquerque. And, they are absolutely safe. They will protect your eyes. But remember, you only need the filter during the partial phase. When the sun is completely covered, take the filter away. Otherwise, you will not experience totality.
Right.
But you must look through the filter until the sun is covered.
Okay. And being a photographer, I've read some things about that, and the recommendations I've heard is a 16-stop neutral density filter is what's required to protect the sensor of your camera. If you don't have something 10 to 16 stops, you can actually damage the sensor if it's exposed for the long periods of time they typically would be if you're pointed at the sun directly. We had some kudos coming through, excellent presentation and so forth from Elizabeth and Bill.
Thank you.
Jocelyn asks, is taking a picture with a camera safe for the camera? And yeah, it, as long as you do have that like 16-stop neutral density filter, it'll be perfectly safe. Now, a camera, you can point it at the sun for brief periods of time without damaging it. It's when you're trying to point it for an extended period of time is when you really get into problem areas that you really do need that 16-stop to prevent damage to the sensor.
Yeah, what I would say, Chris, you see, is what I use for the partial phases when I'm photographing is, if people can see this, this is a filter that you can buy through various astronomical shops, and it's a filter that fits right over the zoom lens on your camera and will protect your camera. So it's the same kind of material that you would have in the filter to protect your eyes. So that is what I use myself. Okay. But remember again, at totality, you must take that off the camera. Otherwise, you will get zero pictures that come out at all.
Yeah, all right. Okay. A couple more comments on wonderful presentation and so forth. Jeff has noted above, about 50 years ago when he was a kid in school, he recalled a story in Columbus evading death by natives. Oh, yeah, Columbus evaded death by natives in Jamaica by predicting a lunar eclipse. Do you know if there's any veracity to that story, Howard?
Yeah, that is correct. That was a lunar eclipse in the year 1504. And it's not really a nice story in one sense. But I think Columbus and his crew, they were running short of supplies and they needed food and other supplies. So he tricked the natives by predicting the eclipse, and they then viewed Columbus and his crew as demigods and essentially gave them the provisions that they wanted. So they really took advantage of the people. But that aside, as far as I know, it is historically correct, yes.
Okay. Tristan pasted in the website for the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and their store. So if anybody is interested, it's there in the chat. Michelle saying, thanks for sharing your love and passion of the clips. Very informative presentation. I'll echo that for sure. Stefan, very interesting presentation. Tom saying, apparently fully exposed and developed Tri-X film is safe.
I would never recommend that, actually. Okay. to use exposed film. People used to do that 50, 60 years ago. That's what, you know, was the old way. But it's absolutely not guaranteed to be safe, because there can be scratches in the film that allow ultraviolet light to get through. So you want to use a filter like this, or a filter you get from the RASC.
Yeah. Spend a couple of bucks and save your eyes. Now, this question from Jocelyn, what kind of material is actually used for the filter? Do you know?
Yeah, it's aluminized Mylar plastic. So it's a very thin film of plastic, and they've got aluminum kind of, I guess, anodized onto it, is my understanding. So it's a very thin layer of metal, and it's removing 99.999% of the ultraviolet light that does not pass through, because it's not the visible light, it's the ultraviolet light that will damage your eye that is prevented from getting through.
Okay, great. Alan mentions that they are $2 at the RASC store, so you can get multiple packs are available as well. Tom pasted in a Google map of the path of the eclipse next spring. And another one from Timothy, Jocelyn, saying amazing presentation. Timothy asks, how long does filter last? He has some from 2017. Do they wear out?
No, if you take care of them, if you don't scratch them, they should last essentially forever. I've been using this one for probably 20 years. It's just fine. I keep it stored carefully, protected, so it's fine. So with regard to the eclipse path, if you Google the weather statistics and other information, and I will be providing you, Chris, this subset of the slides tonight with some of the references, you can easily find out that the further east you go towards New Brunswick and Newfoundland, the cloudiness just goes up and up. Yeah. The further south you go towards Texas, the better it gets. And actually, my wife and I will be in Torreon, Mexico. So we are going to Mexico, where there's about a 95% chance of clear skies. But if you get down to the Texas area, you're getting to probably the 50-50 level or better. So that's something to keep in mind. You've got many months to plan, and the next total eclipse for North America will be in 2044.
Oh, wow.
So you know, this is a great opportunity. You may want to make a little trip out of it and do your best to get to an area with a higher likelihood of clear sky.
Yeah. But as you say, it's not that far away. So even if you're not overly enthusiastic to go far, it's not that far down. Go down by the 401, and pretty much the whole 401 from, you know, they is in the path of totality. So
exactly.
It should be pretty easy to find a place where you can view it. Very cool. Okay, I don't see any other questions in there. If anybody else has any additional questions, speak now or forever hold your peace on it. Oh, we have one from Michelle. How is the time of eclipses calculated?
Okay, well, to predict when and where an eclipse will happen and the period of totality, the beginning of totality, the end of totality, you have to know exactly where you are. And you have to know exactly where the sun is in the sky, exactly. And you have to know exactly where the moon is, because all these things interplay to give you the shadow of the moon touching the surface of the earth. So the way this was done in the time of Edmund Halley, it was with hand calculations. Later, somebody actually developed a three-dimensional model. It was a little machine that kind of moved around. And he had a light shining on it, believe it or not, this was 200 years ago, that enabled them to make fairly good predictions as to where the track would be. Now we know, as I mentioned earlier, exactly where the moon is to within centimeters. With the GPS network of satellites, we know exactly where things are on the surface of the Earth. So with digital computers, you can very easily calculate the positions along the path.
I'm rather astounded that Halley was able to do hand calculations and actually the predictions at that point. I mean, they, you know, I assume it had to be based on observations
yes.
as to where things were, and to be able to have it that accurate, that's really astounding.
Well, it's a tribute to astronomy back in 1715 that they knew these positions based on measurements with telescopes extremely well. So Halley was able to do it, and the ability to calculate and predict only got better over time.
Yeah, amazing. Okay.
Howard, the maps that you showed of the paths, those shadows are moving, what, east to west? Is that correct?
The shadow is coming from the northern United States up over eastern Ontario. So it's west to east. The shadow moves west to east.
So the shadow always moves west to east on all the paths, correct?
Unless there's a very unusual situation with the geometry, which I can show you offline, Daryl,
okay.
The shadow always moves west to east. That's because the moon is traveling in its orbit west to east in the sky. So the shadow follows the motion of the moon over the Earth.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Howard, this is your friend Ron from Payson, Arizona. We've seen several eclipses together. In fact, I met Howard back in 1974 at the San Francisco airport, ready to board a flight to Australia where we saw an eclipse. Anyway, being very quick about this, in 2017, we saw a total eclipse from Wyoming near Thermopolis. And a couple of things to learn about an eclipse through a populated area where a lot of people are seeing it. If you make a motel or hotel reservation in advance, you're likely to get a call from the hotel saying if you wish to keep your reservation, there's going to be a surcharge, and it could be many hundreds of dollars. They were charging, in some cases, $900 a night to stay there.
Wow.
So if you decide, well, I'm going to go to Kingston, and I'll just see the eclipse from there, two problems. One is it may cost you a fortune. And second of all, if the weather turned cloudy and then you decide to drive, everybody there is going to be doing the same thing at the same time. My recommendation, if I lived in Ottawa or if I lived in, let's say, Albany, New York or something like that, would be to get up at 1 a.m. on the eclipse day and find out the best area to drive to and beat the traffic by doing it in the middle of the night. So just a few perspectives on that. I'm going to leave the rest to you. Great presentation. And all of you in the users group really got a treat. This was really special. Thank you, Howard.
Ron, thank you for that comment and the advice. And what we did in 2017, I didn't show that eclipse because, you know, I could have shown lots of others, but I didn't show that one, is we essentially took over a motel in Thermopolis, Wyoming. And what Ron Smith did, my friend and colleague who just spoke, he actually went there and spoke with the owner about a year in advance and made the arrangement so that 8 or 10 of us could rent motel rooms there. It was a privately owned motel. And through that arrangement, we were very sure that the price would not change. But that's what it took.
Yeah, that's quite the deal you have to go through. But yeah, that's really good advice. And if they are in the habit of just telling you, you know, you're screwed unless you pay lots of extra money, that would be really disappointing if you had planned to view it and are all of a sudden faced with no hotel room.
Yeah, I went to see the 2017 eclipse. I rented a place for a few nights in St. Louis. And I went to a place called DeSalto, just about 50 miles south of St. Louis, just almost on the exact center of the eclipse. And I went to St. Louis because that was a good place. Otherwise, if the weather was bad, I would have been gone towards Kansas City because I know the weather does change. And I didn't have any problems with the pricing of the hotel.
Yeah, when you're in a major city like St. Louis, you're probably okay. In a smaller town, it's another story. That's when the prices can change. Timothy, I'm glad you had a good view and that you had a very successful eclipse. That's great.
I made a trip out of it. See Chicago, St. Louis, and Indianapolis.
Yeah, good idea.
Are there any websites that show the current clouds and their thickness?
Sure. You know, there are websites that will have satellite photos, either visible light or infrared, that will show you cloudiness. And these are things that you've got 5 months to investigate to find the best sites. But that's exactly what you should be looking at in the 48 to 24 hours before the eclipse on April the 8th, to plan where you are going to go. And as I said earlier, mobility is the key, and my friend Ron emphasized that. Mobility is the key.
Yeah. Well, it's really good to have an airplane.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, or a hot air balloon or something. Okay, I think we can cut things off at this point. I would like to extend my gratitude on behalf of the Ottawa PC User Group to Howard. Fascinating presentation, really clear explanations about what was going on, and really brought a lot of clarity to me about how the eclipses actually operate and so forth. So it was absolutely fascinating. I'd like to thank you very, very much for taking the time to come talk to us this evening. And from all of the comments I've seen in the chat window, there are definitely a lot of people who share my enthusiasm for it. So, and I see Bob Harris with 2 thumbs up. And like to thank you a lot, Howard. Great, great presentation.
It's been my pleasure. And thank you for inviting me. Thank you for this opportunity. And I wish all of you clear skies and a wonderful eclipse on April the 8th, wherever you are. So thank you.
And to you as well, Howard. So Howard will be sending me an abbreviated deck that we will be putting up over the next couple of days. It will go up with the, unfortunately, on abbreviated audio track. We do have a transcript of the entire one. So that will go up on the website as well over the next couple of days. So if you're interested in any of that, I'll just visit our website and you'll be able to listen, see the abbreviated slides, and read the transcript as well as contents of the chat window. So with that, I think we will call it a close for the evening. Thanks very much, folks. Don't forget that next Wednesday night will be our next Q&A. If you have any questions or shares you want to send in advance, please do so through the suggestion box at opcug.ca email address, and we will see you all next Wednesday night. Thanks, folks. Take care.
Four 400 times closer.